You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here, we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Hi, my name is Melanie. I'm going to be in first grade, and here's my dream playground. I got some swings to jump down. Here's a light climbing wall and some steps. And there are some slides to slide down.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator and your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor, your host, and with me today is the president and CEO of Kaboom, Lisa Ratliff. Lisa recently came into this role in the last year. And Kaboom is an organization that works to create safe play spaces for youth around the country. We're going to talk with Lisa about the important work she does at Kaboom, get into some of the more general issues about what we need to do for our kids, particularly now, since they've gone through more than a year of a pandemic that has kept them indoors mostly, and what hope she has for the future generations of our young people as Kaboom goes about transforming its work in ways that create even greater opportunity than they have over the last 25 years. Lisa, welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast.
Thanks for having me, Art. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, Lisa, you've recently taken over at Kaboom. Why don't you tell our guests a little bit about what Kaboom is and what it does?
Oh, absolutely. Kaboom is my life's mission. Kaboom is a 25-year-old organization that is really focused on bringing kids and communities to envision and design what their play space looks like, and then bringing them together to build it. We exist because there is inequitable access to and quality of play spaces in this country and in this world. And Kaboom thinks it's necessary for kids to have amazing, safe, beautiful places to be able to live out their childhood. And so we work with communities to design and then build them.
You know, I'm old. I remember growing up being able to just run the streets pretty freely. I grew up in an inner city neighborhood, and the kids were always out playing, maybe too much. And I just recall how even in a maybe under wealthy community or a poor community, economically, how much fun we had as kids. And we got to negotiate how we led, and we got to learn from different games that we created on our own. And then it occurred to me a bit later in my life when I started having kids of my own, how unfeasible that was. It didn't seem that kids could just go out and play anymore, and that everything we did with our kids seemed to have to be part of some type of organized activity. And, you know, my kids came out okay, I'm happy to say. But I wonder if you think there's something that's also lost about just the freedom that kids have to go out and do things unscripted and just play.
I do. I'm over here just feeling nostalgic hearing you talk about your childhood. I think so many of us that were born maybe mid to before 70s had this incredible free experience no matter what our circumstances were. So I grew up in government housing, went to Head Start. I had, you know, a tough environment, but my childhood was magic. I remember just running until the lights went on in our apartment complex to us all meeting at the playground and just the magic of it. I've talked a lot about my first memory being on the playground. It was where I really learned how to take turns, to celebrate successes, to find superpowers, and to take my first risk. I tell a story about jumping off a swing, and I was too afraid to jump off the swing like everybody else. And my friends pumped me up and got me to jump off the swing, and I did, and I bit it. I passed out and opened my eyes, and my friends were cheering me on, and I jumped up and I did it again. And there was magic in that. It truly was, I think, if we all look back, the time in our lives that sets the blueprint for everything else. And along the way, I'm a mom. I have a 21-year-old and an 18-year-old. And I think along the way, play got so organized. You know, my kids were active and very competitive in sports. And we had to make conscious decisions to make sure we were going to the playground. We had to organize. We had to pack bags. It wasn't something that happened so naturally. And that's, you know, 20 years ago. And I look now at our kiddos and the integration of play and playgrounds and just going outside and being able to freely live your childhood is becoming something that we organize and we put on the back burner. But for kids, it's everything. It is their blueprint, and it is really the formation of everything that they have the potential to become. So yes, long way to say that I think that something has changed, and I think it's up to us who know the value of that kind of free play and being able to go to an amazing place to play to make sure that we are creating that and prioritizing that for our kids now.
Would you say that something changed? Could you identify what that is maybe, or give us your sense of what that is, why kids are not able to do that anymore? Or maybe we just know more about safety than we used to or something. I don't know. But it's different. And I'm just curious what you think about that.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm not a social science major or anything like that, though I do pay attention to the barriers for our kids to be able to go out and play. And I do think a lot of things have changed. I think parents are worried about the safety of their kids. So you recall in like the early 80s, we started becoming aware of kidnappings and harmful things happening when adults weren't around. And I think it created a generation of parents that have been very protective of their kids, and rightfully so, making sure that they're safe when they're living their childhood and going out and play. I also think we've gotten very competitive. And so we are confusing play with things like, you know, going out and playing sports, which is a form of play. Absolutely. And I spent many, 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 many hours on soccer fields and track fields. But I think that we as parents have substituted organized activities with free play, and kids need both. And so I think the combination of just feeling like our kids need to be safe, and in order for our kids to be safe, they need to be in our sight, and being a little bit too busy to be able to bring our kids to the playground, and the infusion of just doing the childhood being defined by sports or activities or errands or other things that are keeping them busy, where play has gotten put on the back burner.
What's your sense of the cost associated with the child's development when they don't get that opportunity to just go out and play without parents organizing it or some type of organized sports activity per se?
Yeah. And, you know, I want to be clear. I think both are important. My kids learned so much through sports. And so I think that there's a place for both. But we know, you know, there's research and all sorts of endless studies that tell us all the things that happen through play. Most kids learn through play. Most adults learn through play, just, you know, whatever form of play that we define for ourselves. But they learn through play. They take risks through play. They're social and community relationships are built through play. And so there's a lot of risks when kids aren't able to practice for life freely on the playground through climbing high and then climbing higher the next day and learning how to overcome their fears, to negotiating turns on a slide and working with other people. You know, those are skills that kids learn on the playground and then they take into adulthood. And for a kid, it's their natural instinct, not necessarily to open up a book or to sit at a desk for hours and hours, but to really work out physically their imagination with others. And so play is such a necessary part of how our kids develop. So there's a lot of risks associated with not making sure that they have that as an equal part of their learning and upbringing and the activities that they participate in as a child.
So how is it that you devoted your career to this? How did you get here? I noticed you were with other organizations that kind of focused on childhood development in some way. How did you end up taking this on as a career?
Yeah, well, so my biggest cause is play. So for me, it started in childhood. I say all the time, our blueprints were formed in childhood, and I'm certainly no exception. So I was born to teen parents who were, you know, my mom was white, my dad was black. My mom was 15 when she had me. She finished high school in a year and a half and repurposed her entire life around me and bringing me up and making sure that I had this awesome childhood and was protected from a lot of the trauma that was going on around me. And my dad certainly was part of building that community as well. He was a high school athlete and had this amazing, loving, beautiful family that really poured themselves into me. And yet, my dad was black and my mom was white, and they came from different worlds. And my mom's family did not like black people. So there was a lot of racism that I was brought into. But I became the ultimate unifier. And so my presence, just my birth alone, brought together two families that would have never been together. And that for me was the first taste of a big part of my life and certainly a bigger part of my career, which is all about bringing people together around kids. And so I am not only a champion for making sure that kids have amazing places to play and that they have equitable access to safe places to play, but that people unify around making sure that happens and making sure that they are prioritized. And for me, it started from the moment I entered this world with not the best circumstances, but certainly a loving community around me and the necessity just by my very presence for people to learn to love each other because a child's life was on the line. And then I'll tell you just along the way, you know, I told you the story about, you know, my experiences on the playground. That was my very first memory in life was my friends. If I close my eyes, I can just see them so clearly. My friends, the friendships that I built, the things that I learned about myself, all happened on the playground. I married my childhood sweetheart. We were on that same playground together when I was a little girl. And then when I became a mom, I had an experience with my two kids on the playground where a stranger stopped, who's an educator, and he stopped and said to me, "That is the most important thing that you will ever do with those kids is kneeling down and getting down, digging in the dirt, being in the sand with them and learning to speak their language will give them and you something that nothing else will." And I believed that and I lived it. And so all of these things that happened in my childhood and then all of these things that were reinforced along the way really spoke to me about how I would use my life. And so early on, I was in for-profit doing corporate work, and then I moved, my passion moved me into nonprofit, which is not something that I was a part of growing up. I just did not realize that people were putting their hearts and souls into other people in this formal way. I thought, you know, everybody just goes and earns a living. but I went to work at Habitat for Humanity, which was all about bringing people together in common purpose, and Save the Children, which was all about making sure that our kids had access to early childhood education. And while I was there, one of the projects that I did was in South Carolina. We built a library, and there were probably about 70 kids there who kept saying, yeah, but look at our playground. And the playground was the exact replica of the playground that I played on when I was five. So this is 30 years later, having a playground that whose swings didn't work, that was very old, and the kids just saying, hey, we just want a place to play. And when I found Kaboom, or Kaboom found me, when we found each other, I knew that my entire life had been built toward this purpose. And so I would say that it didn't, you know, wasn't one thing, but it certainly started from the very moment that I entered the world. I was taught about the very values that this organization exists for.
Well, you mentioned that you come from a family of mixed race. And I know that we've talked before about various types of disparities. And certainly there are many disparities that we see between blacks and whites. But are there significant disparities when it comes to play and play spaces that you can talk about?
Absolutely. There absolutely are. And remember, we're a country that we were segregated, right? So there was a place for white people to play. There was a place for black people to play. And there's this powerful photo that I have printed out and I look at every single day by Gordon Parks. And it's called Outside Looking In. He was a life photographer that photographed Southern scenes of segregation. And it has, I think, there's four black siblings outside looking into this phenomenal playground that was only available for white kids. And we're built on that. Like our systems and our country is built on amazing access for one and no access for the other. And we've been trying to work to repair that for decades now. And I think there's still so much work to do. If you look into our school systems, which I spend a lot of time doing, and a lot Kaboom spends a lot of time doing, and so do our peers. You know, if you start digging into the race and economic data of who has what, there are school systems and park systems and cities that are celebrated for amazing access to great places. And yet, if you start segmenting zip codes and you look at the schools or the parks or the communities within those zip codes that are predominantly people of color, you'll find there are entire schools in zip codes that do not have one single playground in the same kind of city that is celebrated for their public space. And so absolutely, the inequity still exists. There is, you know, we can't turn anywhere now without seeing people who are championing a more equitable country in our future. And so inequity is a part of the fabric that we're trying to rip apart and repair. And it absolutely exists where kids are playing.
So let's talk for a bit about how Kaboom goes about doing its work. Now, I know that since I've been on a actual build that you do use a lot of volunteers and outside corporate support and support of others to make these projects come together. But what is the genesis and how did these projects actually come together into something that ends being a beautiful and functional playground for children?
Yeah, oh, I'd love to. So, and we're work in progress as well. Like everybody else, you know, there's reflections we've had to make over the past couple of years to really think about, you know, how do we do more with our resources and our energy and our time? We, like I said, it's our 25th birthday this year. And for 25 years, we have been really looking, we've always existed to make sure we are addressing inequities. And so really looking toward working in communities where there might not be a playground, an unsafe playground, not safe access to a playground. We have historically had a funder who's interested in bringing resources in the form of finances and volunteers, and I'll tell you about that, to come together with community who looks at designing their space. What should their space look like? Do I want a blue slide? Do I need benches? What do we need in this space? So bringing our funders together with community in need and designing. And then, like you said, our work is built with many hands. So historically, we have taken the energy and interest of the community and the energy and interest of our funders and the design that the kids and community create, and we bring them together and they build a playground. Most of our playgrounds have been built in like 6 hours. So you imagine this magical moment where the community's coming together, volunteers from our funder, whether it be a corporation, a foundation, or an individual, they come together and they build this dream of the kids and community in 6 hours. And there's mulch moving, there's cement being mixed, there's playground structures going up with about a dozen hands lifting them. So there's this magical space where we just unify and get incredible play space in the ground and then cut the ribbon at the end of the day. Where we've had to acknowledge that we need to make some shifts is in the past couple of years, we built our first playground in DC and went back and built our 3,000th playground in the same community that we built our first, which was phenomenal. It was a great day, and it's a beautiful play space for the community. But we recognized that we are not doing enough to change cities and change systems. So coming back to the same community that we were in 25 years ago was a bit of a wake-up call for us to think about how we work differently. How do we partner better with municipal systems? How do we use more data to inform and understand what's going on and where there is inequitable access? And let all of that information tell us where do we need to do our work and what is the scale of work that we need to commit to ensure that when we're done, it's not one playground, it's equitable access across that city, across that system, across that place to everybody within it. So the schools example where there's, you know, whole zip codes without a playground in their school, we wouldn't go in and build one playground. We would go in and build all eight in that case. And so, yes, volunteers are a huge part of what we do, but part of our growth and our challenge moving forward is how do we take all of the things that are special about bringing community and volunteers together to be able to accelerate toward impact? So what is most important for us is making sure that communities participate, that we understand the problem at the scale it exists. So we've used data to do assessments and really see what's going on, and then make a commitment to, no matter what it takes, whether we are using volunteers or we're building the playground with Kaboom and our playground manufacturers, we are getting those spaces in the ground so that this generation of kids can benefit from having equitable play spaces.
Well, clearly, there are numerous moving parts involved in yes. The work that you do. You know, it's a lot more complex, I think, than people realize. I mean, our team had the opportunity to participate in a build in Southeast DC a few years ago. And as you mentioned, I mean, there was all kinds of things going on, mulch, cement, moving equipment, building slides and swings and, you know, you name it, all this happening at the same time. And so I know that behind the scenes, there's a lot going on too, to coordinate all that. But it just occurs to me, and I'm going back to what we discussed earlier about disparities and how we get people to recognize these disparities. When you go to a build, you see everybody. You see America. I mean, when we were there, there were white people, there were black people, there were brown people, there were red people, there were corporate people, there were people who knows, maybe they didn't even have jobs. But we were all out there for our time to build this playground. And I've said this before to other friends in our sector. What is the role of our sector in helping us both create reckoning, because we do have to deal with giving people the knowledge and appreciation that we do have these disparities and people are not being treated fairly, but also bridging our society, particularly now when we have such a torn social fabric, or how I might say a polarized society. How do you think Kaboom can play a role in helping us do both?
Yeah, I was on a call the other week and somebody mentioned our sector as being the secret force, right? So the relationship that exists between nonprofits that exist to partner with community to solve problems that may have been overlooked or not addressed for too long is special, and it's also a huge responsibility. And so for us across the sector, I think that we are challenged in this moment to really look at how do we build on the years and in many cases decades of work, expertise, and trust and partnerships that we've built with community to partner with the private sector, with the government sector, with others to truly unify our efforts in ways that bring transformative change, not one-off change, not, you know, one project at a time, but really aligning our efforts, resources, and our interests to center communities and have an accelerator kind of put on all of our work. At Kaboom, we've always, you know, we've been built on partnerships. So everything that we do would not happen without a partnership with a community, a funder, a government entity, a school system, a park system, a peer nonprofit, a Boys and Girls Clubs. Partnership is central. But even at Kaboom, we recognize that if we are going to have the kind of impact on this generation of kids, then we need to work differently across the sector. We need to get more organized and together be the surround sound for a healthy community, both in partnership with each other across the sector and with government and the private and philanthropic sector as well. So we certainly feel called, and I can speak for a lot of peers that I've been talking to who also feel called to double down on our commitments to work smarter, harder, and in better collaboration with one another.
So two questions about that. Operationally, what will change in your organization, in your opinion? And then when you talk about making these shifts, how will society and our kids benefit from them?
Yeah, so I'll speak for Kaboom operationally. I think there's two layers to it. So one, so much is changing about how we work. And it goes back to what I was sharing with you about going back to the same community to build our 3,000th playground that we built our first playground in, and recognizing that on the front end, data needs to inform our work. We need to equip ourselves to be partners with others, whether it be peer nonprofits or municipal systems, school system, parks departments, to understand what's going on, right? Like to look at systems and cities and data to tell us where are their play spaces, where are their play gaps, where are their unsafe places, and use that as the starting point for our work, which shifts our operations where we want to use that to inform how people support us. So we have a partnership with Baltimore City Public Schools, where we did an assessment of all of their schools. And we know that we need to build 30 more playgrounds with them to ensure that every single kid who goes to Baltimore City Public Schools has access to a great and safe place to play. That is a significant operational change for us, but a necessary one if we are going to address place-based inequity. So that has to change. How we work with communities has been growing, and we've been strengthening that for years now, and have had to adapt ourselves so that we can have a model that's flexible enough to be responsive to the unique needs of whatever is happening in a community. So whether it be the kind of resources they can come up with or what they envision for their space, our job is to organize ourselves in a way that can be responsive to that versus them being responsive to our process. And then on the back end, on the operational side, is making sure we are investing in the resources to measure the outcomes that kids and communities benefit from, or that we need to address to ensure that they do, to make sure we're holding ourselves accountable to measuring those outcomes. So it could be anything from, because of how we work and bringing community together, community cohesion and a sense of togetherness and belonging in public space, or the outcomes that we see a lot of studies on and the whole reason why play is so important, you know, what happens for a kid in community because they are playing, what are the health benefits, what are the learning benefits. Those are all operational shifts that we have had to make and commit to making as an organization so that we can focus on place-based equity, so that we can focus on staying in a community until the problem is solved at scale, and so that we can hold ourselves accountable to the work that we do, having the right kind of outcomes for kids and community. So those are more operational things that we've have to shift. And have had to shift and have to build over the next couple of years and certainly strengthen. But we also have had to adapt our mindset and how we approach partnerships with others. So flexibility is necessary. Recognizing where our own limitations exist is necessary. Where can we be partnering with others that may be able to complement what we do? And so building a partnership with a nonprofit peer that can come in and strengthen and enhance what we do versus trying to take it on ourselves, that we are completely open to. And it's not something that is a solid operational change, but it is something that is a mindset shift for us in terms of how do we accelerate what we are able to achieve through partnerships with peers and a willingness to acknowledge and then adapt anywhere that slows us down.
Children from Burlington, North Dakota express what they're looking for in a new playground.
A really tall slide.
A roller coaster.
I want a playground that's safe and fun.
A rock climbing wall that's kind of like this thing that you hold on to and you like slide down it.
A football field.
So let me try to make this as concrete as I can. If I identified an area in my neighborhood that I felt needed a playground, how would I go about working with you, if there is a way, to actually get a playground built?
Yeah, so we always want you to tell us. we get that a lot. So you can go to kaboom.org and there's email addresses. You can call us and reach out to us and say, hey, you know, I recognize that, you know, I live in XYZ. I'd love for you to look into whether or not this is a Kaboom type project in this community. And we would explore that. We need partnership in community. So we would need partnership with whoever owns that land. We would need partnership with the resources. But I think more importantly, we would really need to work with whoever we're partnering to assess what's going on more holistically. So is it that one playground? Are there other playgrounds in a 10-mile radius that need to be changed? Are there other playgrounds within that system that need to be addressed? And we would want to pull peers and resources together to be able to do that work so that the benefits that take place from building that one playground can happen across the entire community. So you'd reach out to us. And, you know, our job is to address place-based inequities. And so we would do everything within our resources to identify whether or not that's a project we can do. And then we would roll up our sleeves and make it happen.
I really feel that what you're doing is the ultimate in collaborative engagement, because I think of a movie or how a film is produced. You know, you have actors, you have people who do photography and script writing and wardrobe and set building and all of that, right? Stuff I don't even know about in the filmmaking industry. And then the film has to be distributed. And it occurs to me that all of these different independent entities seem to come together to make this film. And they make the film, and then they go about another project with a whole different host of characters in a whole different, you know, location, maybe with a whole different theme for the film, even for the next film. And I'm just curious if this is how Kaboom operates, or is it more of, you know, we have some pretty set partners, and when we want to do a project, we kind of know who we're going to work with? Or is it, you know, every city, every location is different in its own way?
Yeah, that's, you've been to a build, so you have a good visual for all of the things that need to come together to get a playground in the ground. We will move mountains for kids. And so, though it seems very complex and like there's a lot of moving parts, you know, our priority is making sure those kids have a space. Your analogy is right. In a lot of cases where, you know, we're working in a new community, we're working with new people, we are bringing together strangers that have never met before, and we certainly had never met them until this experience. So that happens a lot in our projects, but the magic there is consistent. I will say a bigger and growing body of our work is around partnering with entities that are committed to multiple projects. And so the example I mentioned about Baltimore City Public Schools, where we would be working project after project after project with a superintendent or leaders in the community, would show up at all 30 of the builds that we do. Even though the community faces might look different, or the volunteers might be different, or it might be funded by somebody else, it would be the same group of people who made a commitment on the front end to saying, we're going to address this inequity across our system, across our city, across our, you know, child serving network, whatever the case may be. So we are growing more of that work, particularly in some key cities. One of the things that we're working through right now is, you know, really coming out of COVID last year, where we recognize the urgency of addressing childhood and play and play spaces and a sense of bringing communities and people together for kids being more urgent than it has ever been before. We are committed to impacting this generation of kids whose childhood was put on hold this past year. So we are looking toward doing deep work with that organized kind of group in at least 25 places. So though you would have a lot of scenarios where there's new faces, you'd have a lot of scenarios where we've locked arms and said, together we understand the problem, together we are committed to addressing it, and together we are going to work, whether it's two projects, three projects, or 50 or 200 projects to solve this problem.
That's really wonderful to know. And what keeps you up at night about this whole area that you're working in? What are some of your biggest concerns and obstacles that you need to and hope to overcome?
Yeah, now you're right in my heart. I think, you know, I'm a mom, and though I have two daughters that came from me and my husband, I feel like a mom for all of our kids, and such a sense of responsibility to use my life and to use our work to support and bring about a healthy childhood for the kids that are kids now and the kids that are yet to come. And I think about everything that kids went through last year. You know, there's an entire generation of kids whose parents were put out of work, who lost their family members and dealt with grief at an accelerated rate. They didn't have access to their schools, their teachers, their sacred space. And the toll is very difficult to calculate. And I think it'll be years before we know the impact that has happened on this generation of kids just by putting their childhood on hold. We're starting to see some early studies where there's like 6 million more kids going to food banks. The test scores are dropping significantly, and significantly more when you're looking at kids of color. Kids who have missed class has more than doubled. And there's, I think, an estimated 3 million students that are unaccounted for. And so I think about this past year and the disruption of our lives, but the disruption of the stability for kids and what we need to do as adults to take this past year and ensure that it becomes an asset for them and doesn't create toxicity in their life, that it fosters resilience and understanding and the tools and skills necessary to build a better future for us who will rely on them one day. It keeps me up that I want to make sure that we're doing enough. And I think that that doing enough is the work that that is right in front of us and is in the next couple of years. And so I get up every day thinking about how can we work harder, smarter with others, build the right kind of partnerships, really focus our efforts so that the five-year-old who was wondering why they couldn't go to kindergarten last year comes out of it and says, you know what, I had a great childhood. We had a lot of strange things happen, but what a gift that gave me. The responsibility of that as a mom, as a parent, as somebody that is leading an organization that's focused on bringing communities together for kids is something that is very significant for me.
If you could speak to, and you maybe you do, I don't know, President Biden and the Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who's Speaker of the House, and Chuck Schumer and other people who are leading our government, would you say to them that we are appropriately prioritizing kids right now? Or would you say that there's more that we need to do? And if so, what is that?
If I could speak to them, one, I would thank them because Kaboom has just really started to step into our government affairs work. And we've partnered with the independent sector to co-lead a nonprofit investment advocacy group. And this White House has really opened up a dialogue with us and our peers so that they are listening and learning and open to partnering and collaborating across the sector to inform government decisions. And so I would thank them for that. And I think that there's a lot of listening and reconciling happening right now. And certainly the one thing that I would raise is, oh, but our kids, all these decisions we need to make around the stability of adults, of families, of society needs to be strengthened in a way that becomes transformative and reformative for kids and the future of our country.
Yeah, I worry a lot about our young people. I have 4 grandchildren. The youngest was born this past weekend.
Oh, congratulations. Yeah. Congratulations. That's magic. Babies are magic.
Yeah, he's a wonderful little guy. And, you know, I think about where we will be when they're old enough to have grandchildren of their own. What will they be saying about the world we left them and the struggles that they had to endure in order to get to that point in their lives? When they're my age, they'll have lived well into the 22nd century. And we can't even envision what the world will be like then. But we have to do everything we can now to make sure that, one, there is a 22nd century, and two, that they're in a position to fight to save this world and to create relationships and meaningful engagements and dialogues that go to, I think, the strengthening of communities, people, institutions, and causes. And so as we head toward the end of this interview, Lisa, the first thing I want to do is just thank you for being willing to take on the challenge that you've taken on. I can see when I talk to you, I can hear the passion that you bring to this work. I can see that your heart is completely open and entirely into it, and your head is focused on getting it right for our kids and for our families. I was so excited when you got the job, and then when I had a chance to speak to you on another matter, all of these things became so obvious to me about you. And so I'm wishing you continued success. I know that you have lots of challenges ahead that you want to achieve, things that you want to achieve. And I just hope that you get all of the support that you need from businesses, from government, from communities, from individuals, from whomever, so that you can do this great work at this new level of activity that you're planning for. And so in addition to all of the well wishes, I want to say that I'm praying for you and I'm praying for Kaboom. I'm praying for them because I'm praying for our kids too. So I'll just maybe leave it at that and let you have the last word here.
Well, I will thank you for that, because I mean, you hit me right in the center of my heart. My eyes are welling up just with love, and I don't know, just a sense of togetherness and the responsibility that we have as the adults to care for each other in a way that doesn't just take care of things that need to happen now, but more importantly, builds an amazing future for that grandkid of yours and for the kids that we will never even know in our life, but will inherit everything that we spent our lives doing. And so I am an eternal optimist. Like, there is no escaping my optimism. I grew up with a dad that always said, you know, it can always be worse. And so I took that as a real challenge to not wish away the gifts that are in front of us. But I think that as we are putting our hearts and hands into action as adults and humans who care, who want to create something different, that we're not just doing it for now, but we're also doing it for our future. And it may be a future that we never, ever see, but it will be the one that we will be responsible for building.
Well, thank you. And to our guests, you're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast. My guest has been Lisa Ratliff, the CEO of Kaboom. I thank you for listening, and you can find us on all major podcast platforms where you can subscribe to hear other episodes and updates of new ones that come out. Thank you for listening.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. Send your comments and ideas to Nona@thusmarket.com. That's Nona@thusmarket.com. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's terms of service.